It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. New style cocktails are rocking the world, and the cocktail party is back big time. Now, for the ideal DIY home bar, we've got some experts. David and Leslie Salmonson of the 12 Bottle Bar fame, and they've got some keys to hosting that party.
When you enter the door, I am your host, and I have a responsibility to take care of you as a guest. I have a responsibility to offer you something tasty to drink, and if I'm offering you something to drink, I better be offering you something to eat as well. And if I'm offering you something to drink, I better know how much I'm offering you to drink if you're driving home. So you have a real responsibility to not only take care of your guests from a social standpoint, but from a practical standpoint as well.
That's David Salmonson of the 12 Bottle Bar. Stay with us. Lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. One of the most delicious things you can bite into is a banh mi sandwich. Now, this is the everything sandwich from Vietnam. And everything means that you've got a stubby baguette stuffed with wonderful contrasts, like creamy and crunchy, savory, sweet, and tart. And then you've got the bite of fresh chili against those cool green tastes of fresh herbs. Now, if you know the right codes, you can make a banh mi that's as good as anything from a Vietnamese sandwich master. Vietnamese food expert Andrea Nguyen has written the manual. It's called The Banh Mi Handbook, Recipes for Crazy Delicious Vietnamese Sandwiches. Andrea, good to have you back with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Now, just a little background on the sandwich. I know the French occupied Vietnam for almost 100 years, if I recall. So is this sandwich French or is it Vietnamese?
Well, you know, Vietnamese food is just inherently this hyphenated cuisine. So, you know, it's got the influence from China, so East Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, and then here come the French. And when they occupied Vietnam, they brought along their ideas, including, you know, baguette culture. And somehow along the line, the Vietnamese started baking baguettes. And I'm not quite sure how they turned out those beautiful, lofty baguettes, but they did. And people started lining them with pâté. And then the 1940s around Saigon, they started putting in different kinds of Vietnamese charcuterie, and then pickles and chilies and cucumber and cilantro. And they would like smear mayonnaise or butter on the bread. And then they would also kind of like do this Jackson Pollock treatment with maggi seasoning sauce, which is sort of like this soy sauce condiment that the French brought to Vietnam.
And what does banh mi mean?
It's a funny word because it means bread. It also means sandwich. And so, you know, it's like a shortcut for saying sandwich. And when we say banh mi, we can mean, you know, it's bread. It could be sliced bread. It could be a baguette. But over time, it's become known as like the ubiquitous Vietnamese sandwich.
Interesting. And it really doesn't taste like any other sandwich. It's amazing, the contrast in all those textures and flavors. How do you put together the great banh mi? I mean, what are the absolute essentials of it?
Well, you know, you need a really like light piece of bread. Think of it like the shell of or frame of the sandwich. And go to the supermarket, folks. Don't sweat it too much, is what I tell people, because you can make it out of like sliced bread if you'd like, just as long as it's kind of toasted. Ciabatta, a bolillo roll, a cubano roll, or a supermarket, you know, quote unquote, French baguette.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get bread that's artisanal and chewy with a lovely crust, because that's going to scrape up your mouth. Because what you're going to do next with it is toast it up in the little toaster oven, mm-hmm. and then cut it open and then rip some of the insides out, because you're going to be filling the bread with a lot of stuff. I like to smear mayonnaise and whole egg mayonnaise, please, on the inside of the bread to moisten everything. And then I mentioned, you know, the maggi seasoning sauce, or maggi, as we'd say it in Vietnamese. And that gives like the shots of umami along with the fatty richness of the mayonnaise. Then from bottom to top, you want to put a little protein. It could be grilled meats, or could it even be tofu or even a fried egg? And then you've got your pickled vegetables and then your chili slices, your cucumber, and then your herb. And most of the time that herb's going to be cilantro.
So what's in the Maggi seasoning?
Well, it is, you know, something that was invented in the 1800s in Switzerland by a miller. And at that point, there were a lot of people going into the factories to work because of the Industrial Revolution. So they had less time to prepare meals at home. And so this miller concocted this condiment that would add umami goodness to soups and stuff. And so, you know, it's like just a few drops will help the soup along. And I think that when European explorers went around the world, they brought some of that with them. And so, you know, the French brought that to Vietnam, and the Vietnamese wholeheartedly embraced it as like this kind of, you know, tony import product. And now, of course, you know, you see it at Latino markets. You also see it in American markets. And in the book, you know, I have this workaround that even if you can't find it, you can always make a little substitute using Bragg liquid aminos, which is very, very similar in flavoring.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. That's great. So, all right. So this is how you layer that banh mi, and it's a set way of doing it. What are the absolute things you cannot leave out? The Maggi, I gather, is one of them. What else?
The Maggi is definitely one of them. And, you know, you need this, like, sweet-sour pickle. Vietnamese pickles are not as tart as Western pickles can be. And so, you know, in your fridge, if you've got a pickle like the classic daikon carrot pickle, then you are ready to make a banh mi anytime.
Mm-hmm.
And the daikon should be cut almost like the size of your average chopstick is what I say. Not too small. Not
uh-huh.
a fine julienne.
Okay.
And then the carrot a little bit smaller than that because you want that texture. A lot of Vietnamese sandwich shops are offering just carrot. And you know, carrot alone is not going to do it for this sandwich. You need that little bit of funk from the daikon.
Yeah. And it does have funk. But that pickle is also great with almost anything. I mean, burgers, omelets, and anything.
You're sounding like a Vietnamese cook, Lynn.
No, I love this sandwich. To me, is one of the most delicious things you can put in your mouth. It really is, and I love the flavors of the pickle. Andrea, thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Lynn.
Andrea Nguyen is the author of the Banh Mi Handbook. Now, she left us with a few recipes to set your bag lunch afire. Take a look at her grilled lemongrass pork banh mi and her shrimp and caramel sauce banh mi. And you're going to find them all at splendidtable.org.
Pasta.
Last year, sriracha was the ingredient everybody was talking about. A rumored shortage freaked people out. This year, it's fermentation. I mean, can you name a vegetable that doesn't get pickled? Funky, spicy, tangy, bold flavors are taking over. Well, at least one person is beginning to wonder if that takeover is signaling the downfall of the American palate. Food and Wine's restaurant editor, Kate Crater, joins us. Kate, it's good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn.
So you did this piece for Food and Wine called Are Big Flavors Destroying the American Palate? So what sparked the idea?
You know, I go out to eat a lot. It's my job. And everywhere I went, I started to see pickles on the table. Every restaurant has a starter that has pickles on it. So many restaurants make their own hot sauces now. Every chef in America seemed to be freaking out on not just spicy, but also, as you say, fermented, funky flavors. And I started to realize that I was craving them all the time. If I thought a dish wasn't seasoned enough, I would ask for hot sauce, even in a place where it didn't seem like they would have hot sauce and they would produce hot sauce for me. So I thought, I think I've gotten addicted to these big, big flavors.
Mm-hmm. Chilies are everywhere. And I also wonder about the pork belly thing.
Oh,
and
the
bacon.
Pork belly. It's part of the big flavors. Yeah, bacon is its own separate universe. But it's true, pork belly is probably arguably the most popular protein in the country, or it's probably one that people see more than they see almost anything else now.
Yeah,
chefs
yeah.
love it. And it's so fatty, it's so over the top, and it speaks to this totally over the top kind of food sensibility that so many people have now.
I have a theory about this. I think that those bold flavors, well, they became popular because of some very talented cooks, but also they are a great cover-up for sloppy cooking. And I'd like to know what you think about that.
I think that's a very, very smart observation. I do think that if you have a really hot sauce and your rice isn't perfectly cooked, you know, if you're doing some kind of a stir fry, you definitely won't notice that the rice is a little mushy or that you put too much bacon in it or not enough bacon because the hot sauce is shouting louder than every other ingredient on the plate. So I think, you know, if you're going to make a beautiful omelet or if you're going to braise a piece of meat or make a stew that doesn't have a lot of big flavors in it, there's nowhere to hide.
Who's doing this kind of cooking brilliantly? And what kinds of things are they doing?
I think that there's a lot of different chefs. There's definitely a sort of new vanguard. And at Food & Wine, we do something called Best New Chefs every year where we highlight chefs, and a lot of them sort of signal it. And there's so many roots. It's definitely, I think, all the people from around the world who work in kitchens are huge. Someone will come in with either cousin's chilies or chili paste, and the chef will taste it. And they'll say, oh, my gosh, I need to put this on my menu. So it's really amazing. People don't really look enough into the whole hierarchy of a kitchen or everybody who plays a part in getting food on your table in the dining room. And it's so much more of a team effort than anybody would think. And really, mm-hmm. It could be a dishwasher from somewhere in Africa who brought a hot sauce or brought some chilies or something from South America, Latin America, that's huge, and Asia. Those flavors have become so popular here, and that kind of cooking, people are having so much fun exploring it. And I think also, as people's palates, people in America are eating so much better than they used to, and the quality of food has gotten so high. But yeah. People, Americans are also very competitive, so I think if someone eats a chili sauce that's triple X, XXX, then someone else has to have a chili sauce that's XXXX, you know? And so I think that's definitely part of our DNA as well.
So is the American palate actually changing, or is this just a passing fad?
You know, I think when I wrote this story a couple months ago, I knew that my palate had changed. And I went to a sort of quiet Chinese restaurant, and they had a dish with, I think it was tofu and nasturtium broth. And I thought it was the most boring thing I'd ever eaten, and I'm embarrassed to say it. But I was really wishing that I could ask for some chili flakes or something, which I knew I couldn't do because it wasn't that kind of restaurant.
Right.
But here in New York City, a bunch of French restaurants have been opening recently. It's sort of the trend here. And it's a return to a little more subdued cooking. And I have to say, I'm not freaking out. I feel maybe my palate is evolving and I'm coming back to quieter flavors.
Well, maybe the whole country is going to take that route. Kate,
uh-huh.
Thank you.
Lynn, thank you.
Kate Crater is Food & Wine Magazine's restaurant editor. Her article, Are Big Flavors Destroying the American Palate?, is on Food & Wine's blog, Rant for Your Life. Now, just in case you need a funky recipe for your very own, take a look at spicy peanut and toasted coconut cookies from Faith Durant. You're going to find them at splendidtable.org. Coming up, taking the mystery out of sausage making and what happens when the second generation returns to the farm. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. 56 years old. That's the average age of farmers in the United States, and that number keeps going up as fewer and fewer young people step in to take their place. It's understandable when you realize how much unrelenting work it can take to make relatively little money. Now, for many farmers' children, leaving home means leaving the business for good. Nikiko Masimoto grew up working the peach harvest every year on the Masimoto family farm in California. And though she was a fourth-generation farmer in the making, before she left for college, she thought she was going to be leaving for good. Yet after a degree in gender studies, graduate work in Japanese-American history, and performance art, she returned back to the farm. Our contributor, Frances Lam, talked with her about what takes a young farmer back to her roots.
Hi, Nikiko. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Frances. I'm happy to be here.
So growing up on a farm as you did, you had no choice but to work the summer harvest every single year. You know, 110 degrees, you're picking peaches, you're fixing tractors, you're sweaty. When you left to go to college, how much were you like, peace out, see you never?
I was 100% peace out. I never wanted to come back to the farm. I didn't even want to come back to the region, actually. I was hungry to expand my horizons. And going from a small town and living on a farm to UC Berkeley was the direction I wanted to go. And I never wanted to look back. But, of course, life introduces us to our lack of control of it. And I find myself amazingly back in the exact place I should be.
But when did you realize that? When did you realize you wanted to return to the farm?
I had a very specific moment when the idea came back to me. I took a class in environmental studies my second year at UC Berkeley. And in this class, a guest lecturer came and talked about pesticides. And in this lecture, she talked about what the application of pesticides were doing to our environment and also the public health risks of intensive use of pesticides. And it was not until that moment that I was able to put what my family had done on our small organic 80-acre farm in a global and political context. And for me, as a 18-year-old gender and women's studies major, I realized that coming back to the farm to carry on that tradition might possibly be the most radical thing I could think of. Mm. And for me, that familial connection, I mean, I live in the house my dad grew up in. I lived in this house with my grandparents. It is the house that my Jichon, my grandpa, passed away in. And that core of being, that is what gets me through the 110 degree days when there's still more work to be done. So I'm incredibly grateful for that.
You talk about returning, and I think everyone has a sense of returning. Like when they hear the word returning, it's automatically emotional for a lot of people, and they feel this sort of warmth and they feel this sort of comfort. But it's interesting because when I hear you say it too, it's, you know, you also return to a place that you really wanted to leave. And your father has, you know, your father's, you know, you also come back to a family farm that is, pardon me for saying this, but something of a legendary farm. It's well known, not just for your fruit, but also your father is a wonderful writer and a renowned writer. And I've also heard him say that when he was young, he thought he would leave the farm and never come back. So can you talk a little bit about that experience, that sort of family experience, the emotional experience of returning to this place and the sort of tensions there?
Oh, gosh. I could talk a lot about this. I do think it's interesting that both my dad and I had a similar experience of not wanting to come back at all. And actually, I think that quite possibly was what brought us back, that there was zero pressure. My Jichon, my grandpa, put no pressure on my dad to come back. And I was fortunate that my parents, we never even talked about me farming until I came up with the idea, which was probably the best possible unfolding. As far as the tensions, I mean, working with family is intense. You know, I don't get to clock out and go grab a beer and, you know, contemplate quitting, right? Because you can't quit your family. And so it really has forced and invited both me and my dad and everybody else, my mom and my brother for sure, to really open hard conversations about how we communicate. What are our different ideas of what a farming life looks like, and how do we make all of those come together sustainably, joyously, but also working through conflict? It's been quite an experience.
Yeah, you can imagine that in a lot of family businesses, you know, working side by side. But it's not super typical where that family business is so physical in nature, and you're physically working side by side with your parents. And earlier when we spoke, you had mentioned the experience of aging in your family, yourself. Maybe you said you'd felt like maybe you had come to farming too late in a funny way.
I am very aware that deciding to farm with him really means I'm committing my life to witnessing and being present with him as he ages. And that's not easy. I am still on the you know, beginnings end of my life, hopefully. And I think about what is to come. And he's 60 and beginning to reflect. There are some things that physically over the coming decades are going to become harder and harder for him. And I'm not looking forward to that, but I know that I wouldn't trade going through that for doing anything else.
It was really lovely to talk with you. Thank you so much, Nikiko.
Thank you so much, Francis.
Nikiko Masimoto is the co-author with her parents David Mas and Marcy Masimoto of The Perfect Peach, a cookbook. Francis Lam is writer and editor of Cornbread Nation 7. Now, you can find a recipe for Nikiko and the family's peach melba on the website splendidtable.org. With the frenzy surrounding DIY charcuterie, these days it's easy to wear yourself out, bouncing from making pancetta to ham to sausage to pâtés to bacon. Well, Ryan Farr, chef and founder of San Francisco's 4505 Meats and author of the book Sausage Making, simplifies things by focusing on just one thing, sausage. Contributor David Leet gets the skinny on this true gateway food.
Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure.
So we are going to talk about a subject that is near and dear to my heart, which is sausage making. So can you just kind of tell me, if a cook wanted to start making sausage, what are those essential tools that they would need to be able to do it?
Well, a lot of the tools are not so much the actual physical tool as it is kind of preparation, thinking about what you're going to be doing. And then obviously you're going to need cold meat and sharp knives. When you're grinding meat, you really want to make sure that your grinder doesn't have a dull blade or a dull die. Because that's really going to kind of smash the cells of the meat, and you really want to kind of retain that cell structure as much as possible, because that's what's going to hold that fat and juice in there. It's going to give you as much flavor as possible. But to go back to your question, really simple, you know, a good grinder. If you don't have a grinder, then you can go to your local butcher shop, preferably somebody, butcher shop that, you know, you have a good relationship with the butcher, and you know the meat is nice and fresh and preferably not frozen. And then really you just need meat, salt. And you really need to have a little bit of liquid when you're making sausage, and that can be anything from water, a little water and wine, or just beer.
And why liquid? What does the liquid do?
Liquid helps the protein suspend the fat in the sausage. So you kind of want to think of sausage as an emulsified product. Mm-hmm. Water really helps that protein hold that fat and suspend that fat. And the more water in the protein that you have, the more fat you can put in to a point.
Okay. In your book, you have a very good step-by-step master technique that takes you through, with photographs, how to make sausage. Can you just briefly tell us, from beginning to end, what are the essential steps that go into making a great sausage?
So it's key to have nice, good, cold meat. And when you grind it, it's nice and a clean grind. And then having all your ingredients ready to go once you grind, so your meat doesn't warm up too much. And we put all your ingredients in that sausage and you just mix it lightly with your hand. If you don't want to mix it by your hand, you can use a KitchenAid. Usually say to do about 50 rotations. Mm-hmm. And then once you make your sausage, the key thing is you want to go ahead and try a little bit. We like to cook a little patty on a nonstick pan so we can taste the salt level. And once you taste it, if it's good, then you're good to go. So you can go ahead and put it into the sausage casing, which would be, you know, you have choices of a sheep casing and a hog casing. And then it goes up different sizes depending on what type of sausage you want to make. Or you can just make a patty. There are some sausages that are better, like the maple bacon breakfast sausage. That's a killer sausage. It's great as a breakfast patty. And then there's a hot dog recipe that you could make into a patty, but it's more designed to be inside of a sheep casing that's nice and snappy. And
exactly. You want a hot dog to look like a hot dog.
Exactly.
Then, Ryan, can you give us some tips for those people who want to use casings? For some people, they find it very hard.
Absolutely. They are pretty challenging, especially when they get kind of knotted up and tangled. Hopefully, you have a local butcher where you can go to or a source where you can get these casings pretty easily. And once you do receive them, let them sit and water in your fridge overnight. Mm-hmm. And that's really going to help them pull some of that salt out because they are cured in salt, so they're preserved. That'll help pull some salt out and they'll be more pliable. When you're about to use them, go ahead and let them sit in some room temperature water. That kind of warms them up a little bit, and that also makes it a little bit more pliable. And once you have them on the nose of your stuffer, you want to use a fair amount of water on, you know, I just use like a cookie tray or a marble countertop, or if you have a stainless steel table, use a lot of water, sprinkle it on the casings and on the table, because that's going to allow it to move freely and not get kind of sticky. And
that's as it comes off of the nose and you're starting to make the links.
That's correct.
Excellent.
And then once I do have a coil after I stuff, I look around. If I see some air pockets, I'll go ahead and just poke those pockets. I'm not a fan of just randomly poking all over the sausage. I like to go ahead and just poke wherever I do see air pockets.
One of the things I've noticed when I've made sausage is that a lot of times when they're sliced, they explode out of their slice of casing. Is that because there wasn't enough pricking going on? There wasn't enough letting the air out of the sausage when it was made?
That actually is a result of cooking the sausage too fast at too high of a heat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's a couple things that you can do. One, you just cook, you know, let's say you're grilling it. You just grill it on a cooler part of your grill. You can go ahead and sear it and get a good color on the hotter part, but then move it to a more kind of indirect heating spot on your grill and just let it slowly cook. Mm-hmm. Something else you can do that's really fun is the poaching technique.
Yes.
Is you can take a six-pack of beer, put it in the pot with a bunch of onions, bring it to a simmer, go ahead and carefully lay your sausages in that beer, bring it back to a simmer, cover it, let it sit for about 15 minutes, and then you can go ahead and just char it on your grill, and it's good to go. And you take those onions out, put it on a toasted bun. It's a really great way. And you can do that about an hour in advance, too.
Well, Ryan, this has been fascinating. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Ryan Farr is the founder of 4505 Meats in San Francisco and is the author of Sausage Making. David Leet is the publisher of the website Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Now, check out Ryan's recipe for maple bacon breakfast sausage on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, register for our free book giveaway. We spend time thinking about stocking the kitchen pantry, but what about stocking a bar pantry? Home bartenders David and Leslie Salmonson claim that all you need to launch the perfect home bar is a dozen bottles, and that's not all booze, and a few essential tools. Well, from there, the cocktail combinations are practically limitless. David and Leslie have written a new book called The 12-Bottle Bar. A dozen bottles, hundreds of cocktails, a new way to drink. Our producer Jennifer Russell caught up with them at the Amsterdam Bar and Hall in downtown St. Paul.
David and Leslie, it's great fun to be able to meet up with you both.
Absolute pleasure.
And at the bar, no less.
Yes, a perfect place to do this.
Well, you'll find us at one most of the times.
Okay, so tell us what we need to build a great liquor pantry or bar at home. What should we have on hand?
You need 12 bottles, 7 spirits, 1 liqueur, and what we call sort of our 4 special ingredients, which are vermouths and bitters. Starting with the light spirits, you have gin, which is the king of the cocktail spirits. It was the original spirit that everybody used in drinks and was incredibly popular, still is. We use that for the botanicals. Nothing else has botanicals like gin. We also have genever, which is not truly a light spirit, but because it's the forefather of gin, it's kind of in that category. And genever is our ringer, the one that surprises everybody, and it has this beautiful combination of aromatics and maltiness that gives it a bridge across many categories, from rum to gins to brandy to whatever you want to use it in. And then also vodka, because it is a top seller in the markets. You can't avoid vodka in drinks today, and it's also an incredible conduit of flavor in terms of what you put in your drink, letting that shine through, and also a base for making liqueurs, so you open up a whole nother door to your pantry to create more drinks.
And white rum, don't forget.
And white rum, of course, yes. We did choose two rums, and David will speak to the amber rum, but white rum we included because those are some of our favorite summer drinks, mojitos, daiquiris, those beautiful fruit-forward but still crisp but lovely sweetness, all balanced, and it takes you to a tropical island, so how can you skip that?
Amber rum would be next, and again, darker than the light rum, aged, a lot of barrel characteristics, and you know, vanilla that's coming out of the oak, tropical fruit flavors as well. Marries beautifully with the next bottle, which would be brandy, cognac-style brandy specifically. One of the most elegant spirits that you can find and one of the most versatile. You can use it in anything from a sweet drink to a very stirred brown drink if you'd like. And then rye, and we just love, everybody has a whiskey favorite. We love rye because you can get examples that go up to 100% rye mash. It's incredibly spicy when mixed with sugar and citrus and other ingredients. It just makes a beautiful Manhattan. It makes a beautiful sour. And then those are our seven base spirits, and so then we complement those first with one liqueur. Lots of liqueurs on the market. We think that you need orange liqueur. We love Cointreau because we like triple sec because it's clear, first of all. So whatever drink you put it into, it's not going to color the drink. The king of triple sec is Cointreau. It is just an amazing, amazingly well-made spirit. They have no problem with the other ones, but it's the most flexible thing and a pure orange flavor. And then we get into
Our vermouths. We have a sweet and a dry vermouth. Your sweet vermouth is also your red vermouth, which is used in things like Manhattans and Canada, lovely, slightly herbal but sweet characteristic. And your dry vermouth, also white vermouth, if you have a proper martini, it's used in a martini, which is the king of cocktails, and any number of other drinks, also adding that herbal characteristic but an underlying dry note. And then our final two bottles are bitters. Orange bitters, which of course adds the brightness of orange, but that bitter characteristic, and aromatic bitters, which have all of those Christmas spices like cinnamon and allspice and things of that sort. And that's all of them.
Okay, so for those of us on a budget, how low can we go when it comes to price and quality?
So if all in, if you were to buy all 12 bottles, we have low-end choices and high-end choices. All at the low end, it would be about $200 for your entire bar, and you can make a good number of drinks with this for any number of people. If you were buying all high-end spirits, you're looking at about $350. But you don't have to buy all the bottles.
In fact, we show you how to set up a one-bottle bar. What started cocktails was punch. So if we go to that very basic, you take a spirit and then you mix non-spirity things with it, citrus, sugar, spices, if you will. You can make glorious drinks. We add to that, we have a follow-up chapter called the three-bottle bar where we introduce bitters and vermouth, and then a four-bottle bar where we introduce liqueur. Now, you can mix and match. So again, if you only drink one spirit, you still find use in the recipes.
So that's great. For about $200, people can have a full collection, and you can build up as you wish.
Exactly.
And what about classic or unexpected ingredients to sort of enhance or go with a cocktail?
There are a lot of things that just using a little bit of sugar, some water, and an herb or some kind of fruit will make an entirely new element for your drinks. So those bases, simple syrup is really your king of additions.
Simple syrup is just equal parts sugar and water. You just heat the water slightly if you wanted to. You could just actually just mix them together. But if you heat the water just slightly, dissolve the sugar in there.
And with simple syrup, you can do whatever you want. You can make rosemary simple syrup, basil simple syrup, lemon simple syrup.
Hibiscus is lovely.
Yeah.
So you stress the importance of ice. What should we know about ice?
Ice is as important an ingredient to your cocktail as heat is to a saute. Let's just take an average sour or a martini even. If you start with 3 ounces of ingredients, you're going to end up with a 4 ounce drink. So that means that the water from dilution from that ice is 25% of that drink. That's a substantial ingredient. So it's very important how you apply ice. Now, the bigger the ice, the slower the dilution. The finer the ice, the quicker it will dilute, and the quicker it will chill because of that dilution process. We can talk hours about ice, but you want to use the best quality ice you can get.
Something worth noting is if you are going to make your own ice and it does not have a cover on the ice tray, make sure you cover it with plastic because even the cleanest freezer can leach flavors, and leached flavor into an ice cube is leached flavor into a drink.
And break out those bundt pans, make beautiful ice
for
molds.
Punches.
Put edible flowers and herbs in there and put it into your punch
and
bowl.
And you can do that in your cubes too. The punch bowl story actually brings up a very interesting point, which is the idea of responsibility. And that's not meant to harp or be a public service announcement, but when you have guests, they are in your care and you do need to think about what you are serving them. And not only does that mean, for instance, maybe something like a punch that will dilute and offer you that strong to weak possibility, but also things like having alternatives. We do virgin drinks in the book for exactly that reason.
You're my friend. You're coming to my house. It's great that we're friends, but when you enter the door, I am your host, and I have a responsibility to take care of you as a guest. I have a responsibility to offer you something tasty to drink, and if I'm offering you something to drink, I better be offering you something to eat as well. And if I'm offering you something to drink, I better know how much I'm offering you to drink if you're driving home.
Also, you have a responsibility to enjoy your own party. Many times, and we did this for years, we would get so bound up in the presentation and all these crazy dishes we wanted to make for our friends.
You want to show off, right?
Yeah. And in showing off, you spend your entire night in the kitchen. And we have finally discovered, you know, to our credit, after all these years, don't go overboard. Make drinks that you can prepare ahead of time or that can be batched, which means you make large amounts of them, or that you can even show your friends how to make.
I love that. That is really great advice. Leslie and David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. This Absolutely. Has been wonderful.
David and Leslie Salmonson are the authors of The 12-Bottle Bar, a dozen bottles, hundreds of cocktails, a new way to drink. Special thanks to the folks at the Amsterdam Bar and Hall in downtown St. Paul for letting us play at the bar. David and Leslie have created a special cocktail just for us. It's called the Splendid Cup. And you're going to find that recipe along with a list of 12 essential bottles and a whole lot more on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a minute to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're talking to you this hour. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. Get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, or send an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Max is calling from Chicago. Max, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Thanks for taking my call. I travel a fair amount for work, so I spent most of my weeks living in hotel rooms. And, you know, as much as I love trying local restaurants, I sometimes miss being able to cook for myself. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts of healthy and tasty things that I can make in a hotel room with limited cooking implements, maybe just a microwave and a fridge.
Well, you know, there is the famous ironing board grilled cheese sandwich.
Really?
Okay. Yes, yes, there is. There, in fact, I think it's a wonderful comedian from England named George Egg demos this. He's probably on YouTube. And the idea is that you use the iron. And you need a plate or a paper plate, something where you're not going to put the bread directly on the ironing board. But the idea is that you literally take whatever kind of cheese you like. And, you know, wherever you are, if there's a really good cheese shop or that kind of thing, you can get pretty fancy with this. You could put a little ham in there or some nice raw onion or, you know, whatever you want and whatever kind of bread you want. And you press and toast the sandwich on each side with a hot iron.
Wow, that's a great idea.
Yeah, and then make sure you clean off the iron. But really, with the sandwich, you could really go to town on that. And then you could get some great condiments on the side. You know, some interesting pickles and relishes and that sort of thing could really be interesting.
That sounds perfect.
Where are you now? Are you in Chicago?
No, I'm outside of D.C. right now.
Oh, I think you're going to find a lot of good stuff around.
I am. Lots of good grocery stores.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. These
you are welcome. Take care. Okay,
take care.
Max. Bye.
Bye.
Emma in Iowa says she has an overabundance of garden cucumbers and she can't stand cucumber soup. What is she going to do with all the cucumbers? Well, the first thing I can think of, Emma, is consider a cucumber puree, where you take the cucumber, you seed it, you puree it, you put some chopped scallion or onion in there, you put vinegar in there, and then you add a little gelatin with the vinegar, and then you just gel it. You can gel it in a teacup or whatever, and it becomes like a little cucumber jello. And you can serve that on a bed of sliced tomatoes. It's really fabulous. One other thing that's kind of fun to do with cucumbers is just plain cucumber salads. Slice the cucumbers. I toss them with salt.
after I slice them, just a little, and I wrap them up in towels because that way all that moisture they throw off is absorbed and then they're kind of crisp. And then you can go anywhere you want. You can do them with a bit of salt and pepper, a lot of fresh herbs, and then a bit of oil and vinegar, and you've got one kind of cucumber salad. You can do them with sour cream, a ton of fresh dill, red onions, a little bit of sugar, and a little bit of vinegar or mustard, and you've got sort of a Scandinavian cucumber salad. Or you can do them with oregano and fresh lemon, and now you're in Greece with olive oil. You see where I'm going? You can take them in any direction you want. Also, cucumber sticks or cucumber boats, you know, where you have the cucumber, take out the seeds, and then fill that down the center with anything. I mean, anything from tuna fish to soft cheeses, and you can cut them then into little pieces, and everybody can have just a bite of it. And by the way, I know you said you don't like cucumber soup, but there is a cucumber soup in the New York Times. It's called Asian Cucumber Soup. It's by Mark Bittman. And it is so light and so fresh and so different, and you make it in about 15 minutes. And I would suggest that you take a look at it. Asian Cucumber Soup. And thanks for a great question. Vanessa's on the line from Pleasant Hill, Oregon. Vanessa, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Well, I have gotten into fermenting foods at home. I make sauerkraut and kombucha and lots of pickles and things like that. And I recently tried to make a honey wine, which is just fermented honey
right.
and water. And right. the first time I made it, it worked really well. It turned into this light, crisp, almost champagne-y sort of beverage. But the second time I tried to make it, it developed a mother on top and turned into vinegar.
Very interesting and unusual vinegar, right?
Yes, and so now I have almost 2 quarts of this honey vinegar.
How does it taste?
Well, it's sweet and tangy. If you didn't know that it was honey, you probably wouldn't be able to identify it because it doesn't have that honey syrupiness.
Right,
it just
right.
has this sweetness and it and kind of a tang to it. It's not unpleasant at all, and it's this beautiful sunny golden color. It makes a really great honey mustard vinaigrette, but I don't know what else to do with it.
Oh, I think you're onto something here. You know, one of the things that we don't see very much in our country, but you see all over the world, especially in places like the Middle East, are and also in history books, going back centuries, are vinegars like this. Vinegars made from dates, vinegars made from all kinds of fruits, anything with sugar in it.
Okay.
Would sugar cane, palm vinegar, you see that through much of Asia, especially Southeast Asia. And each one of these vinegars gives something, you know, very different to whatever it ends up meeting up with. The first thing I would think of with this would be think of what you'd like to pickle in it. And I would say you do a refrigerator pickle and not something you plan on keeping for months, you know, something that's going to last several weeks in the fridge to be on the safe side because we're not sure how acidic this is. And
right.
if it's very low acid, it could get tricky.
It's probably not very high.
Yeah. So what this is one of the things I'm thinking. Wouldn't peaches and nectarines and plums be wonderful in a mixture of this that maybe you first of all take the vinegar, part of the vinegar, and you warm it with some spices. Cinnamon stick, a bit of clove. You don't want to overwhelm it. You want to complement it. A bit of clove, some allspice, black peppercorns, and some mustard seed. Now, put that in about, a cup of the vinegar and bring that to a boil and then let it steep for about a half hour.
Okay.
Strain it. Now mix in fresh vinegar, taste it, and then what you can do is either add sugar if you want it sweeter, all right, or just keep it as is, or if it's very, very strong, you may want to dilute it with a tad of water. And then put that into a very clean jar and then tuck into it wedges of crisp but very tasty stone fruit.
I bet that would be good.
And when you get that stone fruit out of there, that stone fruit could be an accent inside a fruit pie where you use some of it mixed up with the fresh fruit. Or it could end up going into greens. It could end up being tossed at the last minute with anything that you're stir-frying. And, of course, if you can imagine what that's going to be like with anything that you barbecue.
Yeah.
Think about that. And then from there, you can go to, you know, the cucumbers, turnips. Thin slices of turnips would be fabulous in that mixture.
Well, yeah, I've pickled other things in vinegar that I've made. I've made pineapple vinegar, and I made really nice pickled vegetables, but
well,
it just didn't occur to me to try that with the honey.
Yeah, of course.
Vinegar.
If you've done it with pineapple vinegar, just think you're going to do it with the honey. And by the way, pineapple in the vinegar would be great.
Now, that's a thought.
Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, salad dressings, marinades would be wonderful. And if it has a really clear taste, wouldn't it be great to sprinkle that over some salmon that you're grilling, just, you know, and let it grill into the salmon so you get that beautiful taste, or use it as a pan sauce and boil it down to a syrup. It will be any vinegar you do that with that has flavor is delicious, but this vinegar I think would be very, very special. Oh, and one last thing.
Okay.
Make some switchel, and that is a couple of tablespoons of the vinegar in bubbly water or in still water with ice, and then a little bit of honey to taste.
Oh.
And it's one of the most refreshing drinks. It goes back a really long time, and in the summer, it's a great, you can add alcohol if you want, but, you know, for people who don't drink, it's wonderful.
Well, thank you for all those ideas.
I hope you have enough vinegar.
I've got enough to play with,
okay.
But I think it's going to go fast now that I have all these ideas.
Okay. Hey, thanks for
thank
a great
you.
Question, Vanessa.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
You can call us. We're at 800-537-5252. And check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Mark's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Mark, what's up? What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for having me.
You are welcome.
This year in our garden, I decided to grow some really, really hot peppers. And the hottest of which is the Carolina Reaper.
I've never heard of it.
It's the hottest pepper in the world. The
hotter than the
record.
Ghost pepper?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's something like 1.4 million Scovilles.
Oh, my God. For anyone who's not heard of the Scoville scale, and at this point, with the love of chilies, it's out there, is that a jalapeno is what?
A jalapeno is right around 5,000, I think.
Oh, yeah. The idea is of something when you're into a million, you're talking about the kind of thing that can silence you for a month. You can't breathe or speak. So what's the name of the chili again?
It's a Carolina Reaper.
Wow. Okay. All right. So you've grown this baby. Now I think I know the question that's coming.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with it, right?
Exactly. What kind of recipe can you use a Carolina Reaper in that's actually going to be edible at the end?
You've grown something almost inedible, and now you want to know how to make it edible. No, but seriously, there are three things that are going to calm down the heat of a chili so that the taste can come through. I'm just thinking with something this intense, if you were to calm it down by 25%, it would still be very hot. But there are three things. Number one is some kind of fat, because the substance that makes a chili hot is fat soluble, meaning it dissolves in fat. Okay. The other things are some form of acid and something sweet. That's why in Southeast Asian cooking, you know, where it can get very hot, you see a lot of play of sweet and tart to balance that. So one of the things you could do with it is slow grill it on a grill. Is it a very large chili?
It's a little bit smaller than a golf ball, maybe.
All right. It's about the size of an habanero, then.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So it's that lantern kind of size. I think it'd be very interesting first to lightly grill it so it softens.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it'd be very interesting to take that, seed it, and just lightly chop it with garlic, a bit of brown sugar, and a bit of vinegar or lemon. And just let that sit for a while. You can put it in the fridge even. At least a day. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I forgot one ingredient. Salt. Okay? And I think what you're going to get is a spread / garnish / sauce that's going to be really interesting, because the sweetness and the nuttiness of the chili will be complemented by the sugar. Some of the heat will be slightly tamed by the acidic quality. The salt will bring out the flavor fully. And that light grilling of it, you know what happens when you lightly caramelize something? You get brings out more of the rich sweetness of it. I think take a shot at that. It's very basic, but it could be really interesting. The other thing that probably would be great in there is a bit of grated fresh ginger.
Okay.
See what that does for you.
Okay, I will.
Okay. And do me a favor. Let us know what happens when you can speak again, okay?
I'll probably put it on YouTube. Something like that. You need to capture.
I love that. The Carolina Reaper. That's better than Ghost Chili, really, in terms of conjuring.
Right?
Thank you, sir. And good luck.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's it for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from William Cullen Bryant, who said, "Autumn, the year's last and loveliest smile." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Visit splendidtable.org to catch up on everything you heard here today. You can register for our giveaways, dig into our collection of recipes, and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalubi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.